I'm Are You Serious? And this is my
show. Show.
Natural disasters,
and eventually the end of the world. Are you serious? Susie Bright has been one of America's top sex writers since the mid-1980s, and today she's promised to lose her virginity live on our show, but first we need to talk to you about a few things, and I want to give Diana Brown is our local superstar, and I want to give her a chance to tell people who, particularly people who are living in the San Francisco Bay Area, how they can actually see her in person.
See that star shine.
Oh, you guys are good to me. It's true. I'm performing in a play called Dead Certain at the Off Market Theaters. We had the pleasure of taking this show to New York last year, and we're back. They gave us a terrific quote from RetrovisionMedia.com. They called our production the sleeper of New York City's black box theater season. So giving us, you know, enough rope to hang ourselves, as it were. No, we're here in San Francisco. We've been doing very well, and the press has been kind to us, so I hope you will come out and see it.
Where can people go?
They can go to the Off Market Theaters, 965 Mission, near 5th Street, and we perform on Fridays and Saturdays, 8 and 10, and a 2 p.m. matinee on Sundays, on Saturdays, excuse me.
That's cool, and as long as we're pushing our stuff on you people, I have an online course coming up at maybelogic.org, and it's about Timothy Leary, his life and his theories, and go there and check it out, www.maybelogic.org. And I also have a new book out. It's called True Mutations: Conversations on the Edge of Technology, Science, and Consciousness. And it will not be in stores everywhere. So go to pollinatorpress.com or go to amazon.com and look for it under its title, True Mutations, because that's you're going to find it a lot quicker than you will looking for it under my name.
And it is an opportunity for people to drink, because you haven't mentioned any of your books in a while.
That's true.
And as on the Are You Serious show, every time Are You mentions a book, we encourage you to take a drink or a drug of choice.
That's true. Go ahead and swallow it down. And we've got Jeff Deal, we've got Steve Robles, and we've got Diana Brown right here.
It's delightful to be here. And while I'm not performing in this play, I am fascinated by some of the work you're putting up on Ten Zen Monkeys, are you?
Why, thank you.
You're very welcome, all of you, actually. A big shout out to Ten Zen. But what caught my eye definitely this week was the story putting those wacky, fun people over at the Church of Scientology back in the news. And it seems they're just not going to take it anymore from anyone. Not that they really...
Yeah, they never did take it.
They really never did before. But now they seem to have gone after a gentleman named Keith Henson. And I'm just going to ask you to start off and explain what's going on with this
poor
man.
Well, they've been going after Henson for a long time. It started off with the discussion group, Alt.Scientology, I believe it was, where people take on and took on and criticized Scientology in the grossest of terms. Ooh. And he made a joke about a Tom Cruise missile and how the missile could be aimed precisely enough to hit the church. And from there, they tried to sue him or something. There was a whole series of conflicts. He was protesting against them, and they basically charged him with something like harassing a church, which is some special law. And he was he went to court, and he was actually convicted, and he went to Canada. He was the Church of Scientology's first exile. But I believe he there was some question about whether he was going to be able to stay in Canada, so he snuck back over to the U.S. And
they don't even want him?
No, they were okay. They actually gave him asylum for a while, but then questions started to come up again about whether that would continue. So he lived quietly for a while. I think, was it in Arizona?
Yeah, Prescott.
And they just grabbed him, and he's been busted, and then he's been bailed out. But I mean, the interesting part of the story, in a way, is that it's a real, it's like a total like Millennium X-Files weird sci-fi
Definitely.
Story, because not only is Scientology strange, but Keith Henson is, you know, part of the Extropian movement. He's into cryonics. You know, he's going to have himself frozen. He's into, you know, all these things that many of my listeners find quite normal. But to say the average American, they might look at it as, you know, two very weird kind of sensibilities.
Worlds colliding.
Two very weird worlds colliding with, you know, certain things in common in a way.
It's true.
One of them, though, being authoritarian and the other being more or less libertarian.
This is true.
Why did he, you know, one of the reasons he gave for going to Canada was that... he was afraid they were going to, they had death threats out against him, and they were going
to. That's what they say.
And if he came back here and served his sentence, someone would get him in prison, or would at least kill him. If he was really that scared of somebody killing him, why did he protest Scientology on their property and say, "Hey, look at me, I don't like you."
it's not like crossing the gaudy fucking boys. It's like
what could be that?
I don't know,
reputation.
I'm starting to think.
The Scientologists?
Yeah,
then why did he go on their property? Then why did he go on their property and say, "Hey, look at me"?
Well, I think maybe it evolved.
Scientology,
I don't see like J.K. Simmons from, you know, Oz, you know.
I know that's just, isn't it that also isn't it just a little bit more likely that he didn't want to go to jail and get raped up the ass?
I mean, that makes a little bit more sense to me.
A very salient point.
It could have evolved. He thought that there were these two women who had died mysteriously. He thought that
on the grounds of the Scientology Church, right?
They had murdered her or something.
Well, that right there demonstrates that they could kill people. So why go and make yourself an open target?
Well, so he thought that, you know, he was a person who could be
a
righteous protester.
Well, what about the Tom Cruise missile thing? I want to talk about this because...
You know, like, I assume that I could go out and probably protest against the Church of Scientology and they wouldn't hassle me too much because I'm reasonably well known, but I could be wrong. And
should we find out?
I could... You know, be coming up in a month and saying, "No, they're really after me, man. They're going to try to kill me."
So, let's picket them when they're in the BART station doing the stress test.
All right, but yeah, I mean, there has been quite a bit of discussion over the last few years among people who are aware of this situation and whether Keith has, you know, went over the top and went into his own arena of paranoia, or whether, you know, there's a realistic threat from Scientology, and there's all kinds of testimony about people who say they've been seriously harassed by Scientology, and who can tell for sure. A lot of people think he's slipped a little bit over the edge.
But you're right in that. Who the hell knows? Because, I mean, even though I say that...
You're talking about a cult that... Didn't they just say that Tom Cruise was the new Jesus or something?
You know, they had a Jesus roaster here in San Francisco.
He's a lot less creepy looking than Jim Caviezel. Although I don't think he could do I don't think the man's cape. Has he ever grown a beard? I don't think I've ever seen him with facial hair.
I've seen him in a beard in one movie or another.
Well, I would hope that Jesus would be a little bit fucking taller. That's all I have to say.
So I guess this means that we don't ever get to interview Beck.
Or Jesus. Or Tom Cruise. Fuck. Who's there left?
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
Susie Bright is a writer, editor, and I think she's still the host of a weekly audio program, In Bed with Susie Bright. Is that right?
You need to catch up. I most certainly am the producer and announcer and chief bottle washer of In Bed with Susie Bright.
Hey, and this is still on Audible?
Yeah, on audible.com.
All right. Well, very good then. And people will check that out. And she co-founded and edited the first women's sex magazine, On Our Backs, which was called Entertainment for the Adventurous Lesbian, from 1984 through 1991. Founded the first women's erotica book series, Herotica, and taught Bukow courses. She's written for many popular magazines, and she's even been in the first Wachowski brothers film, Bound, and on the HBO series, 6 Feet Under. And I just found out one of her classes actually is a workshop on psychedelics and sex, and we're going to find out about that either today or tomorrow, because this is a two-part interview, and she'll be back with us. And she recently sent me the latest edition of the book that she edits, The Best American Erotica, and that's The Best American Erotica 2007, and we'll be talking about that on this, the first part of a two-part show. And welcome.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
All right. So before we get into your book, how's life been as being a sexpert for 30 years? Is it a big responsibility? Is it a lot of fun? You wish you were a fucking fisherman, like John Lennon used to say about being in the Beatles?
That's a good point. You know, on a personal level, sometimes I wish to be unknown, but I think a lot of people feel like that who have celebrity, particularly around my sexuality. You know, for me to be hit on by a guy in the hardware store parking lot who doesn't have a clue who I am, that is so hot, you know, to have a woman in an elevator give me a sidelong glance makes me think I've still got it going on. The sexual attention, the personal sexual attention you get in the limelight of fame, you're always afraid of what people's agenda is. I mean, I locked myself in the bathroom of the last sex party I went to because somebody who I thought was interested in me really wanted me to read their manuscript. You know? So,
well, that's really the scariest thing of all when somebody approaches
like,
you with...
manuscript. I
want to
fuck.
I can just imagine. It's like, does this feel good? You know what I always wanted to do is direct.
I know, it's so demoralizing, dehumanizing. It's all the D words. It's very bad.
Hey, but baby, you want to see my manuscript?
I knew that's
it's
why
hot.
You lured me up here.
It's fucking hot.
But in terms of the social influence part, and I bet John Lennon would say the same thing, you never get sick of influencing a conversation.
Having a voice in the world.
I never get sick of making something different than it was. So that part I always enjoy.
You ever think about it would have been cool to become famous as a writer about a different topic, like television or quantum physics or something like that?
Well, I guess my little sheltered ego, I think I am famous for writing about other things.
Oh, well, you do write about other things, so you can look at it that way.
I have all kinds of plans, you know, and I get passionate about all kinds of subjects, and I have my little, you know, readers who know that part of me, who feed my sense that I'm doing something else. You also have to remember, I wrote for so many years in the political world.
Sure.
Before I got into, until sex started taking into a commercial turn,
right.
That I don't know. I still feel like the world is my oyster in that respect.
The world is your oyster because you wrote about
my pen.
You can write about it.
I can write about anything.
Right.
And
right.
There's going to, if you can write well, if you can make an argument, if you can make people cry, laugh, you know.
And you have the opportunity in your show. Do you you go off on many topics?
I certainly do. In fact. I know
sometimes I get
complaints. They were like, I've got this one Republican listener.
People like their narrow casting,
who,
too.
You know, he writes me over and over again. He wants to discuss his marital situation at length. And, you know, you can only go so far. I keep quoting my favorite dominatrix to him. I said, we're not spanking Republicans anymore. We're not, you know, we're not servicing you with sex tips until you realize that this stuff that you're doing in bed and your voting behavior and your political behavior are at odds, and you're hurting people. Ow!
We can't spank Ann Coulter, though?
Oh, God, no. I wouldn't touch her with a 10-foot pole.
Michelle Malkin, I have my fantasies. But anyway, I do want to ask you right off the bat, actually, because I thought it was quite an intense little piece to read from your introduction of
sure.
the new book.
This introduction, I called it the Lolita Backlash, because every year the stories in the book, even though the authors don't realize it, they tend to magnetize to a certain theme.
Yeah.
And this year, it had to do with a rather vicious generation gap.
When was the moment when our youth became aware of their charms as well as their desperation? They seem younger now, although that could just be my mother talking. But look at our 21st century culture. Every teenager knows the time to launch a career as a porn star is in the weeks following high school graduation. Celebrity journalism shows us that Hercules and Aphrodite will both be toppled in their early 20s without massive intervention. It's no wonder the commodification of good looks and muscles has wrought an erotic backlash. Virginity, authenticity, the natural pearl, these are what are idealized today, as well as commercialized beyond all recognition. Fake sex, titillation, is for sale. Real sex is elusive and underground. Take this state of affairs, couple it with a pox of unprecedented meddling in people's personal lives by the religious right, and the result is a toxic brew. Privacy, freedom, and nature are gasping for breath. Hypocrites alone have something to crow about. In my 15 years of editing BAE, I have never seen such a yowling, lustful, spitting breach between young and old. Of course, such observations are taboo. Lower your voice. Young people aren't supposed to have a sexual bone in their bodies, right? And their elders, if they are immune to beauty and make all the rules, should be able to keep it in their pants. What a squawk. There is so much guilt and fear about the obvious, that young people do have hormones and old people aren't altogether blind, that helpful discussion in the public sphere has shriveled. It is left to fiction for the truth to come out. And the truth looks like this. Any conflict has the potential to become erotic. Such honesty might get complicated, tragic, or unpredictable. Eros is kissing cousins with aggravation. The conscience of our society drives us to protect our young, to provide for them, to cheer and cherish their independence. But we wouldn't need any conscience if doing so wasn't a challenge, if it didn't demand sacrifice. The temptations include neglect, exploitation, and dependence.
It seems like in the thesis and antithesis of sexual revolution and then backlash that we've ended up with such an incredibly tangled state of how we think about sexuality, and I'm talking about the culture in general, that I mean, it almost embraces like the most insane kind of sexual sophistication, and there's all this pornography around, and the most intense kind of puritanism, and it's like all converges into one like confused human being.
Well, the thing that's, I think, is in common between the exploitation commercialism and a lot of the porn you're talking about is the titillation, guilt, taste me factor, where you never really right. get to taste me, ever. I mean, a sexual honesty and being more forthcoming, mm-hmm. real candor, where you really come through, where it's not just, come here, come closer. Right. I'll give you this little bit. But then right. once you get there, you're going to need to get a little bit more and a little bit more, and you're always going to have to shell out. And that's how they sell it, and it's also how they inspire fear politically. It's that same, it's a con job.
And they're creating people who behave that way. The stripper thing is becoming, and the customer for the stripper thing
That's
is
true.
Becoming the way a lot of people relate to each other.
Well,
right?
Daily commerce. I suppose so, except in real strippers, real love lives, it doesn't work like that. So I think even if you try to have a fake persona, you cannot maintain it all the time. It's impossible.
There is a lovely story in there towards the end of the book. I don't remember the title of it. I think Fantasy Girls or something like that.
The Wish Girls?
Yeah, that sort of gets kind of into the emptiness of that kind of
Yeah, that image. Was a great story by a new author who's just completely new on the scene. And he had this idea of this man who's about 30, who when he was a teenager, he had a I Dream of Jeannie moment where he wished there were two hot, bouncy, magazine-y babes would appear and be his love slaves. And he got his wish that they're the Wish Girls. And now they've been around for 15 years. And they do the same exact
positions, and he was so naive when he ordered them. He was like, why did I make them identical except for their hair color? I wish one was 5'2 and one was 5'9. I mean, why? I mean, it just drives him nuts that they are so limited, you know, and he yearns for more. But on the other hand, gosh, you know, they bend over and get in position number 19 and position number 32, you know, just like clockwork. And he feels guilty for his boredom and ennui with them. So what's next in store for him? I won't say any more.
And there's another story in there, though, where some people who are involved in the porn industry are having a pretty interesting time, and they're pretty hot and so forth. Do you think, feel like there's like a clear dividing line between like, oh, this is bad porn and this is good porn? Because I'm always a little suspect of like judging what gets people off.
Well, that's not what I mean when I say good porn and bad porn. Yeah. Lots of times you'll see something that has obviously been made with the most sloppy, fuck it, let's get this done and get a quick buck intentions. And yet as you watch it, you realize that in one of the scenes, you know, one 10-minute scene, the people in front of the camera actually had a moment. And it was caught there because, after all, that lens does capture things between people. Other times you'll be watching something that has been made with such high ideals, and you'll be like, I can't even keep my eyes open.
Falling asleep.
So now, again, I'm making cliches of disappointments or unexpected surprises we may have found. But I'm not, I never walk into a room and say, oh, what? That turns you on? You're gross. I mean, that would be the infantile.
Ew.
Yeah, ew. That kind of small child reaction to spinach kind of thing.
There is this kind of the superior attitude of people who are sort of into underground sexuality.
Yeah, but then there's
more cheekier than thou.
I think you
can.
And
then the opposite of that, where that's all twisted and sick and so forth.
You have the same kind of conversations in every part of the art world. And I just wish people would realize porn's like that, along with music and painting and everything else. You have your little factions, you have auteurs, you have people who have put a signature on the work they do, and there's a sense of the moment you see it, you can tell it's one of their films. If I might tell you an interesting story about this, one of the most important pornographers in history just died recently, and he had his obit was in the New York Times and Variety and every place else, but it did not say that he was a pornographer, or that he had made some of the most influential films, including one that helped me choreograph the sex for Bound, which you mentioned a minute ago. His name was Gary Gravers, and the reason everybody was lauding him so highly is because he was Orson Welles' cameraman for 30 years. And he helped fund a lot of Orson's projects when Orson didn't have a dime coming in anywhere else. And
that's,
it was because of the porn that he did. And I wrote all of these major newspapers and magazines, and I said, why are you not saying that? I mean, you talked about all his exploitation work, his horror flicks, his slasher films, none of which are going to get any rave reviews. I mean, they're laughable. He shot Steven Spielberg's first movie. He worked with everybody. Back when Spielberg barely had, you know, anything going on. So there's lots of laughs, lots of like funny little anecdotes about Gary. His family certainly knows what he was doing all this time. Why wouldn't you say that? And the responses I got just showed the double standard that rules the land. Like, well, you know, we wouldn't do that. You know, why would you besmirch him? He wouldn't have.
Besmirch him.
Yeah. And I would besmirch. You're the New York Times. If somebody does something really bad, like murder someone, but later they discover the cure for cancer, when they die, you still mention that they serve time for that murder. I mean, you guys dig up dirt. You never present like, he had a wonderful life and everything went swell and he died.
Like Larry King interviewing Adolf Hitler. Well, you were a vegetarian.
Exactly.
And an artist, though not a very good one.
So why would you report on people's immorality, gambling, criminal lawsuit, I mean, anything, but you wouldn't mention that they did some of the most significant porn films of all time, things that are still on for sale and have been for sale in every format from, you know, they were released as 35 millimeter, then VHS, and then DVD. You can still get Gary Graver's work. I should say this before everybody forgets it. His porn name was Robert McCallum. And one of his most famous works was something called 3 a.m., and it had a shower scene in it with two women that gave me about 50% of the idea of how I wanted to script the sex scene in Bound. You mentioned that I was in the movie.
Right.
Me being in the movie was nothing. It was me creating the sex scenes and the sexual characters that was the
Jennifer
interesting
Tilly,
part.
Jennifer Tilly, as I recall.
Yeah, and Gina Gershon, both of
right,
them.
Right, very, very, very much fun. We are going to stop for a moment and hear some music, and then we'll be right back with Susie Bright. We're back with Susie Bright, and you did, in your introduction to your book, broach the highly taboo subject of adolescent sex and adolescent sex as it relates to adults. And this topic has come up on our show before, and the first time it came up was we had Tim Kavanaugh, who was the editor of Reason Magazine's blog at the time. And I asked him if his libertarian group has ever dealt with the age of consent. And he admitted, no, that it was kind of the third rail for libertarians, that they were staying away from this idea of the age of consent. And I wonder if you worry if maybe Fox News might notice your book or and this is, I think this is probably more bigger taboo than like murder in America now.
How interesting. Well, it, I mean, it's come up before. I remember when I was in my 20s, I was invited to what was then the TV daytime show, Phil Donahue. He was sort of Oprah before,
yeah, sure,
Oprah. Remember how popular he was?
I was on there once.
Oh, no. Well, you know.
Glory days.
Oh, wow. God. Well, it was one of those gotcha shows,
yeah,
where,
sure,
I was brought in with a bisexual male friend of mine, and we had been asked if we'd like to talk about what we noticed sexually in terms of differences between sleeping with men and sleeping with women. Like, really, not mm-hmm. pejorative or prejudiced or trying to start a fire, but just, you know, like, what do you notice?
Sure.
And Phil and I, that was my friend's name, we thought that would be a lot of fun. And I got picked up in one of those big limos where, you know, in New York, and they take you to the studio. And inside the limo was this very pink, perspiring couple from Florida. And I said, you're going to be on the show too? You know, not thinking that anyone was on the show besides me and Phil. And they said, yes, we're from Exodus. Now, Exodus at the time was the premier gay conversion group.
Whoa.
Woo-hoo. Gay conversion.
Gay conversion.
It's coming back.
Coming back stronger than ever. It's down to 3 weeks now.
Conversion to or from?
Let's do that again.
Yeah, next question.
Oh, where were we?
It's coming back. Gay conversion.
It's coming back. Now they've got it down to a 3 week spot.
You were telling us about
nice.
The Donahue episode.
That's right. So we go to Donahue's show, and it turns out they're basically trying to get the Bible couple to freak out on us and vice versa about why we're heathens. And it was so humiliating. We didn't talk about anything that I had planned on speaking on. And at one point, just me and my big mouth, but I would have said it to anybody. I came of age in the 70s, and I lost my virginity shortly before my 16th birthday with an unemployed soap opera actor. I mean, that is a banal story.
Like you were
story.
Supposed to in America,
yes,
in the 70s.
That's exactly. Everyone did that.
Since the 70s.
It's in the handbook, I think.
Yeah. And so, and all of a sudden, Phil turns. He's thrilled, and he goes, so you were a victim of child abuse.
Did he go to commercial at that moment?
Exactly.
Cut to commercial 30 years later.
And
every channel.
I was like,
victim
you
of
son
child
of
abuse.
A bitch. What a gratuitous dig.
Right.
And, you know, neither I nor anybody in my family feels any regrets or fears or like, gee, Susie was in an awful lot of trouble or panic or danger. I wasn't. I mean, this is a tricky subject in the sense of sensitivity to young people's development psychologically and physically,
right,
because after all, some people are such old souls, so young, you know, and other people are just crawling out of their egg at age 25. You also have the quite noticeable difference in terms of girls and boys at this age. I mean, I see my daughter and her friends, and you don't know who's 10 and who's, you know, 20-something when they all might be 16.
Right.
They're so different. Or you'll have somebody who, these are the ones who are suffering the most, I suppose. They're the ones who look 10, but, you know, emotionally and mentally, they want to do everything. Then you have others who, I mean, you hear all the time about girls who say, I had breasts when I was 10 and everyone was sexualizing me,
right,
and I just wanted to be in a tree and have everybody leave me alone. So many misunderstandings, and adults are constantly projecting their notions of what they want on you. In my case, and in a lot of people's cases, I was the one who was seeking sex and interested and curious and
You hear that story all the time, yeah. Pretty much.
But the way that if somebody else comes along who doesn't have empathy and compassion and respect and decides that, yeah, girls want me, that teenage girl over there, she digs me, that kind of narcissism. I mean, that's the problem. We don't talk about sex as a matter of, is it consensual? You know, right. Is there coercion involved? What is the power relationship between these people? Instead, we fixate on these stereotypes and miss the big picture. And the other thing that so many people don't bring up is that overwhelmingly the sexual abuse that's happening, the violence that's happening is within families. And if you wanted to stop the cycle of that, that would really be remarkable. We have this sort of idea fostered by J. Edgar Hoover that there's these monsters out there that are going, these strangers who are going to come up and offer your child a lollipop. And that's where things are all going to start to go downhill. And we see that replayed out now on the internet. There's a wonderful social scientist, Michael Mels. He just had an opinion article in the New York Times. And he was talking about, it's great. He's proved that your kid is safer alone on MySpace than any shopping mall in America. I just love reading his facts and figures because it all makes sense to me.
It seems so obvious if you think about it.
Yeah, it sure does. I mean, that yeah. guy who was running the Predator arrest campaign for Homeland Security, I mean, he was the guy who was exposing himself to 16-year-old girls at the mall. I am not making this shit up. I mean, with all the fuss about Scooter Libby and, you know, Cheney, other things have been
glossed
over.
Were they caught together?
No. I mean, we've got so many big fishes that are in trouble.
Yeah.
But what fascinated me last year was how many of these officials who are supposed to be running our security, our child protection plans, they're the ones who are being indicted right and left for being really creepy, totally non-consensual predators.
Well, they're the ones who are attracted to that. I mean, just like certain sadists are attracted to law enforcement or whatever.
The mice are guarding the cheese at this point.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So when people ask me about public policy, I start thinking about the big picture. If this country had more active democracy, things would be better for young people. If we had decent health care and universal sex education, things would be better for young people. Anything you can do to give them power is going to work out. Anything you can do to foster good family relationships and support education. I mean, you could go on and on. None of them are on the agenda for the United States right now.
Sure.
Well, you're doing something for young people on your website with Lyric, and there's a bit of a betting pool going on, and it's not just a snarky little jab at this fool in the media, Ted Haggard, but actually the proceeds of this betting pool are going to benefit Children of Lyric in San Francisco. Is that correct?
Yeah. Does everybody know what Lyric was? I thought I had to explain it.
Please do.
Please do, because all of our listeners are not in San Francisco. But
all right, Lyric. I'll get what it's the name screwed up if I try to do the acronym. But it's a youth group, a community support and activism group for young people who are knowing that they are sexually different, whatever that might mean to them. You know, nobody like makes you fill out a form explaining what it is, but that you know that you're sexually different and you want a place where you don't have to be alone, where you don't have to be stigmatized, shame, that you might get support in terms of work and family that doesn't exist elsewhere. It was started in the Tenderloin and originally was serving a lot of young people who were runaways or who were working on the street. And it just grew and grew. And they're a role model for young people of like getting together and doing it for themselves and having adult advocates who have a lot of integrity. So I love them. And when this whole mess with Reverend Ted Haggard happened, I mean, this is Mr. Evangelical minister to end all evangelical ministers. He told George Bush what to do. That's how big he was. He gets caught sucking cock, you know, on a regular basis.
On crank. It's the only way to do it.
He's like the alliteration of it, though.
No one wants to do it without meth anymore, apparently.
On crank. It almost sounds
pleasant. And instead of copping to it, he's, you know, just said, hey, I was always heterosexual. It was just stress or whatever it was. And he's been given a huge check by his church because they are hemorrhaging money. And he signed a confidentiality agreement and given a plane ticket to get out of town. Of course, everyone who heard the headlines, Ted Haggart, 100% heterosexual, you know, says...
Now, didn't he go to a three-week spa?
He went to a three-week spa, you know, to get over his homosexuality, which he really didn't have. I mean, you know, like the contradictions are endless.
I love that. I mean, who's going into rehab today? There's this ongoing, it's become a daily thing now.
So everyone was saying, when do you think he'll slip? And I said, you know what? Let's do a betting pool. So I've started Bet on Ted, betonted.com, and or you can go to my blog, and you just pick your date. Anytime, we're going to give it a year. Anytime this year, and what we're betting on is something that gets reported in the news or the courts. And we've come up with a list of things. Any of them would involve Ted cracking and it hitting a news report. As soon as that date happens, if you have the lucky date and you can bet on as many dates as you want, then you win half the pot and the other half goes to our worthy cause, Lyric. If nobody gets the right date, or damn it, if Ted is sneaky all year and nothing, you know, comes out, then the whole pot will go to Lyric too. So, yeah, bet on Ted. I'm hoping we get somewhere with it. Even though he's so fun to laugh at, the thing that really got to me was somebody said, just imagine what he could have done. I mean, what if a guy like him had come out and said how sorry he was and addressed himself to all the closet cases
out
there?
There was somebody who was associated with Falwell who actually did that.
God, bring him out. You know, have him make a phone call.
Yeah, he has been out, and I think he wrote a book about it.
Well, what's so interesting, remember I told you about those people from Florida I met at the Donahue show? The founders of Exodus finally did do the right thing. Fled Exodus, so to speak. They exited Exodus.
So much in a name.
And said, we are gay. God damn it, we're sorry we just did this to everybody.
We're so damn gay.
We're so gay. What a stupid thing to do. All the founders of all these horrible conversion therapies have recanted after a certain amount of time goes by.
Skittles.
And it just, the hubris of these people, of Ted's church and the Bush administration and so on, to think that somehow they'll just pay him a lot of money and it'll go away and no one is ever going to say anything, right? I mean, they are that deluded.
Well, maybe Ted will do the right thing. And come on.
Well, one of my friends who wanted to bet said, can we send in a ringer?
No.
And I said, yeah, make it happen.
He'll come with a heart of gold, it'll bring him across.
Exactly.
Oh, I bet goodness. A lot of people are trying to reel him in at this point. This is lucky. It's his lucky year.
We're Ted fishing now. Ted fishing.
Ted's going to get a lot of action this year. Thanks to Susie Bright. I'm afraid we're going to have to close out this show, but we're going to have Susie back for another show. And I promise, I know you've already taken all your hallucinogens because you thought we were going to talk about her workshop in this show, but we tricked you.
You'll have to get
take some more hallucinogens
day.
Next week, and we'll be returning with
That's
Susie
right.
Bright.
Stay high. See you next week.
Love is the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?